sometimes readers say to me something about some particular scene, and as they're describing that scene, they're adding little parts in. So they're, because I'm thinking, no, I didn't write that. That's your imagination.
Welcome back to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell, and that was the voice of the novelist Leanne Moriarty. Leanne is probably best known as the author of Big Little Lies, which was a 2014 novel about a domestic abuse secret in a tight community of school parents. It became a glossy HBO miniseries 3 years after it was published, with an A-list cast that included Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon. Leanne has also written 8 other novels, including The Husband's Secret, which was her first New York Times number one bestseller, and 9 Perfect Strangers, which also became a TV drama. This year she published Apples Never Fall, which is about what happens when your mother goes missing and your father becomes the number one murder suspect. I spoke to Leanne last month. It was 8 in the morning here in London, and it was 6 p.m. at her home in Sydney. She sold over 20 million books worldwide, and her characters have been played by the likes of Melissa McCarthy and Meryl Streep. So I would say that objectively, Leanne is an extremely successful woman, but it made me smile to hear how low-key and self-deprecating she is. She talked to me about her no-planning approach to plot, the usefulness of writing exercises and prompts, and how she feels about reviews. This is also the 3rd episode in a row in which the guest has talked to me about the importance of turning off the internet, so I think that's probably some kind of sign. Of course, the brilliant Meg Mason was on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and she also lives in Sydney, but she's from New Zealand, so Leanne is actually the first Australian guest I've had on In Writing. That's quite special to me because, weirdly, this podcast has quite a lot of listeners in Australia. I think this year so far it's been listened to about 10,000 times from Australia. So that is really special to me and very surprising because I've only been to Australia once and I only know a handful of people there. So it's very nice to finally have an Australian guest, and hopefully there will be lots more to come. This week I'm happy to be welcoming a new sponsor to the podcast. The Novelry is an online school that goes beyond creative writing courses. If being published is your goal, the school's in-house professional editors will help you get there. The editorial team will take your manuscript to publishing standard, identify potential literary agents for you, and work with you to submit your novel to their partner literary agencies on your behalf. If you're just starting to write, the Novelry offers inspirational courses that will help you grow your idea into a novel with a friendly community of fellow writers. And if you're already writing and you want the support and guidance to finish your draft, the Novelry's novel writing courses will see you all the way to the end. You'll enjoy daily lessons featuring advanced storytelling created by Booker-listed award-winning author Louise Dean, one-to-one mentoring from a best-selling author tutor of your choice, and live writing workshops and Q&As with guest authors and agents to inform and inspire your writing. You'll find a very warm welcome waiting for you at The Novelry, so book a free chat to discuss your writing at thenovelry.com. That's thenovelry.com. But now, over to Leanne. So are you in the room where you would normally do your writing?
I am in the room where I normally do my writing, yes. And as unfortunately you've heard, it is joins the kitchen. So it's very much part of the whole of the family household. My desk is treated with cheerful disrespect by the entire family. So I've got all over, I've actually got a lovely desk. It's a long antique just table, really, but it's extremely messy. I would be mortified if you could see it right now. And yeah, there are notes for an essay that my son's writing on The Merchant of Venice, which sadly I never studied, so any tips would be appreciated. There's an empty tub of yogurt. There's also some in relation to writing. A friend of mine gave me a beautiful hourglass, which I do use. I think it goes for half an hour, and I often use it if I'm stuck with my writing. The rule is that I just turn it over and say, I have to write for that time. It doesn't matter what I write, and I'm not allowed to go back and edit. I'm not allowed to think about it too much. And often if I'm stuck, that hourglass gets me going. I'll stop talking soon, but there's so much.
Please don't.
On this desk.
Please keep talking.
I've also got, I went through breast cancer this year, and my sister gave me this to celebrate the last day of radiotherapy. She gave me a beautiful wizard. And he's holding, so it's a, you know, a pottery, and he's holding a glass ball and with a wand. And she was saying this could be my muse for future writing. So he's sitting there next to the computer screen. So he's very lovely. And I have, this will be noisy, I have this beautiful silver mug that, I'm filled with sad stories now. I also lost my dad just before the pandemic, so I've got a lovely a silver mug that he was given. He was a surveyor, and it was given to him by the Surveyors Association. So that's sitting in front of me. And the last thing I'll tell you about is I've got a little, I quite like Billions and some of the, you know, the series Billions.
Yeah, yeah.
And somebody gave me a little figure of Bobby standing there with his hands in his pocket. So I'm looking at Bobby the wizard and the hourglass.
So is it, you said it's near the kitchen, and obviously it sounds as though the family encroaches into your very sacred writing space or not very sacred writing space. Is it a kind of open plan room? Just paint the picture for us a little bit more.
It's a very ordinary room. I always remember doing a radio interview once, and I was asked this exact question. And then I went back downstairs and got in the car with my husband, and he said, right, first of all, when you ask the question about where do you write, you can't just say it's an ordinary home office. You should make it sound, you know, with the book lined and make it sound far more romantic. But it certainly is book lined. There are books everywhere. And it's just, I think it was used as a bedroom before, and it looks out on the backyard, and it's just a very ordinary room. I can't make it sound any more romantic. I can see the sky, and I can see some beautiful trees looking outside.
That's
but
lovely.
I'm not on a mountaintop.
No. So are you writing a book at the moment?
No, I'm not. I never write while I'm in that sort of the publicity time. But so I've just launched a new book, and I do find that there are two different parts of your personality. So I feel that I'm performing as a writer now, and I need to stop all that before I can write again. I need to stop talking about myself. I find it impossible to write if I've done an interview. You know, sometimes my publishers will say, oh, could you just do this interview? You know, it'll only take 20 minutes. But I have to explain that in the time leading up to it, I'm too aware of myself. And then for hours afterwards, I'm still thinking of myself. And the whole point of writing is to lose your sense of self. And I can't stand then sitting down and thinking, oh, look at me, you know, I've just talked about how I'm not a planner. So look at me not planning. I can hardly stand it. So no, I'm not writing until I close up shop.
So, I mean, you've published 9 novels now, I think. Is that right?
Yes, yes.
And so what is there a kind of decompression process that happens between wrapping up that publicity and then drifting back towards a state of mind where you're ready to start thinking about another novel?
Yes, and I haven't really worked out what I should do to make that happen. I find that normally in the days go by and I always think I'll have a break. And I think it's normally when I start to get irritable, when I think, really, okay, it's time now. You need to be working on something new. I do find it, you know, because I can easily go for a day without writing. That's no problem. I can go for quite a few days, but I can't go for a certain amount of time when I finally get back into the writing, I think, oh, what a, I didn't realize I was missing it so much. I need it. I feel like it's like exercise, you know. It's easy. I can go a few days without exercise, but, you know, then when you finally exercise again, you get the endorphins going. It's exactly like that.
Yeah. Well, for me, it's a bit like exercise in that I know that I will be pleased I've done it, and I know that I'll enjoy it in some way while it's happening, but I put off doing it.
Yes, it's the same, and also it's the same with the warming up, you know, because I often do these spin classes, and I can't stand it in the beginning and until something happens, and I guess it's just warming up, and then finally something happens and you enjoy it. So yeah, the writing's exactly like that too.
So when you are writing a novel, do you have a kind of daily routine with your writing, or could you talk me through that a little bit, how you approach it day to day?
Yeah, that's another question where I feel like I wish I had a better answer, because I really enjoy hearing other authors when they describe a beautiful ritual to their day, you know, where they get up at this time and they have a cup of tea and they walk through a forest or something and recite a little mantra. So I don't do any of that, and I would blame having children, but I really didn't. I wrote a few novels before I had children, and I didn't have beautiful rituals before then either, so I can't really blame them. The only things I do are I must have coffee in the morning, and I always turn off the internet. So I have that, do you know that program Freedom?
I've heard of it.
Yeah, I've seen it in the acknowledgements of a few authors' books. And it restricts your access to the internet. And so I muck around a little bit when I sit down at my computer and, you know, look at emails and all that sort of thing. And then when I go into that Freedom app, it feels like it's almost programming me to write. So, and you can put in the number of hours that restricts your internet access. So I feel like if I put in 2 or 3 hours, then I'm programming myself to write for that length of time. And I do tend to write in a 3-hour shift, which I did get into the habit of writing for that long when the children were little, because I'd have a babysitter who would come for 3 hours at a time. So I think I've ended up thinking of myself as writing in 3-hour shifts.
Do you have a sense of what you would typically, I suppose, when you're in that writing stage rather than the later editing stages, do you have a sense of how much you might write in 3 hours, or is it how long is a piece of string?
I think in the beginning I'm always happy if I've written just 500 words. I do think that since when the children were little, I was extra productive in those times. So perhaps it used to be this way when I only knew I had 3 precious hours, and I couldn't leave this room because there was a babysitter out there and she'd know that I'd already left the room to have one cup of tea. And so it was wonderful. I might have rose-coloured glasses when I look back on those times. But yes, so I'm definitely a word counter. And I do feel like at the beginning of a novel, because I'm not a planner, so it's always hard for me to progress. I'm more inclined to edit what I've done the day before. So in the early stages, I'm happy if I've done 500 words a day or a shift. But later on, then I'm hoping to do something like 1,500 to 2,000 words.
And what are your first memories of being interested in writing?
When I was a little girl, I used to just love to write stories, and I loved writing in exactly the same way that I loved other things in my life, like riding a bike. So I always think when I'm sitting down to write now that I'm always searching for that uncomplicated pleasure that I used to get from writing when I was a little girl, that there was no self-consciousness about it at all. It was just writing for this is a fun thing to do. And yes, when I was little, when my dad discovered that I liked to write and that my next sister down liked to write too. He actually used to commission us to write stories for him. So he gave us our first publishing deals. So I do remember that that made us feel important. It felt like it was a job.
That's so sweet and so clever. I think that's such a nice thing to do for a child. To make it feel important and worthwhile.
Yeah, it made you feel very validated to sit down and as if this is your job. And I have to say, it's never worn off, that feeling of this is such a privilege to sit down at my desk and be paid to make up stories. I can't believe that I get to do that.
So at what stage I know that you had another career in advertising before you became a novelist. So at what stage did you really turn your focus to becoming a professional writer?
So I didn't turn my focus to that until my sister did it first. As I got older, I wrote less and less. So I lost that crazy self-confidence that I had as a little girl. I always had a job that involved writing of some kind. So I had a career in advertising, copywriting. I did get quite corporate for a while. And in fact, that's what I was doing. I was a marketing manager for a publishing company when I got the call that my sister Jackie, her first novel, Feeling Sorry for Celia, had been accepted for publication. And so I was very happy for her because I love her dearly, but I was also filled with envy because basically she'd gone ahead and achieved our childhood dream and I hadn't even given it a shot. So apart from the envy, there was probably also a kind of fury, really, because I was furious with myself. Because, you know, it would be different if I could think, well, I tried, but I didn't get there. I honestly hadn't really tried. All I'd done in that time, I'd written a few short stories. I did finish one children's book, which I wrote for my youngest sister, Nicola, who is also now a novelist. So there's 15 years between myself and her. So I must have been 25 because I know I wrote this for her 10th birthday. And so that actually many, many years later was also published. And the main character is called Nicola. But that was really the only thing I finished because I wanted to do it for her. And so then when I got the call that from Jackie, I would say in a fit of sibling rivalry, I wrote another children's book actually, and I know it was around the year 2000 because I was inspired by the Sydney Olympics, and I wrote a book called The Animal Olympics, and it was about all the different animals that would win the Olympics if they entered each of the sports. You know, like the ant would win the weightlifting and all that sort of thing. And I mentioned this sort of defensively because I still think it was pretty good.
It's a great idea.
thank you. but no, that book was enthusiastically rejected by every publisher in the country. And that's when I calmed down a little bit because really, it really was all about quick, you know, what have you been doing? And that's when I enrolled in a master's. And that for me was what I needed. I needed that structure. And because, you know, I'm a good student and I wanted to impress the teachers, and you only had to write 30,000 words to finish it. And I wrote 100,000 words, and that became my first novel, which was Three Wishes.
Wow. So what do you think you took from that master's? Do you think it was mainly just the kind of accountability and structure of having to churn out, though, sorry, I shouldn't say churn out, having to produce that beautiful,
you're allowed to say churn out,
beautiful manuscript? Or are there other things that you remember kind of picking up from that course that made a big difference?
I think it really was the accountability. I really do. I'm sure there were little things about technique that I picked up. Yeah, to be fair, there were things about technique that, and, you know, polishing my writing, and also I remember just little exercises that was just waking me up. So just being asked to, you know, to write in another author's style, things like that were just loosening up your creativity. But mainly it was every week, because it's just so hard to write your first novel, to not, to just be, to keep going at it. And so knowing that that each week you got feedback both from the lecturers and also from your fellow students. And I can always remember coming home from those classes each week, and on the way home I could feeling my face in the car, and my face would be all red from my cheeks would be burning with the nice things that they'd said about my work. So I think I'm so grateful to the, because I know that's not actually the case for every master's course. I hear that some people are horrible, but I have these wonderful people who just kept me going. And the main sensation I had was one of relief that I was actually finally writing again. I didn't realise how much I'd missed it.
It's interesting when you said about, being set exercises, like having to write in another author's style or whatever. Mm. And I remember, because I interviewed you a few months ago for a magazine, and I remember you were talking about how for your latest novel, Apples Never Fall, one of the elements that kind of became part of the book was a little exercise or a prompt that your sister had given you, where she, she'd written the kind of beginning of a scene and given it to you to continue with. So even after you've written so many books, you still sometimes find those kinds of little experiments or exercises helpful?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, that was the first time I've ever asked Jackie to do that. And that was because I had planned to take a year off before I started anything new. And in fact, I think I did have in my head that I'd do things exactly like that, like just little writing exercises. And so I asked her to send me, a writing prompt, and I thought I'd just write a short piece. And so she just texted a few lines describing a scene of a bike lying on the grass beneath a tree with a few apples lying on the grass next to it. That ended up becoming the opening scene of the novel. I think those things are great, and I think I'll do it. That will become my ritual. That's what I'll do next time.
So glad we figured that out.
Yes, thank you.
So what do you remember about writing your first novel? And looking back on it now, do you think you've kind of honed that process since then of how you sit down and approach a novel?
Well, as I say, I do remember it was just a wonderful time in my life, that sensation of relief and joy that I was finally doing it, and that I was loving these characters, and I could, see the chapters sort of, piling up, and that I was thinking, I'm actually going to do it. I'm actually going to finish, I'm going to reach that summit. So again, I didn't plan that book because you had to write a little bit for each class. So I remember with the very opening scene, I had used something based on a short story that I'd written. So I didn't plan it all out. And because you weren't meant to finish it, so you didn't have to do a plan. So I haven't changed that. I still just seem to start with a premise and keep writing and take it from there. I don't know. I don't show it to anybody now as I did with that first novel, and I don't like the idea at all of showing it to anybody now.
That's interesting.
Until it's completely finished. No, I can't stand the thought until I know how it's going to end, because I'm not a planner, there are so many things that I want to go back and fix, or that they might be reading it, but I might end up changing my mind about that. So nobody gets to see it now till I'm done.
Do you tell people what you're working on, and do you give them an outline of what it is, or do you just keep it under your hat?
I do if I need to. So this latest book I had, tennis was a backdrop. So I've definitely let people know that I'm if there's a particular subject, because I'm always desperate to talk to people. So I had somebody who did online trading. I tell people if I'm desperate for information. So I remember being at a children's birthday party and I was telling somebody I need to learn about tennis and I need to learn about online trading. And he must have been eavesdropping on this conversation. It was, one of my child's friend's dads. And he texted me afterwards and said, here's the name of somebody who used to be a competitive tennis player and then went into online trading.
Oh,
so
wow.
There was the perfect, I know, the perfect person that I needed. The information that I need, but I don't talk so much about the premise.
So your fifth novel, The Husband's Secret, was your first New York Times number one bestseller, which must have been an incredible feeling. What do you think it was about that fifth novel that kind of took you to the next level? I mean, when you look back on it, do you feel that it was better than the first four, or do you think it was just kind of chance that it caught the zeitgeist? Or
I think it just seemed to take a darker turn than the previous novels. So maybe it was just, and that maybe that was a time when people were looking for those sort of domestic suspense, and it was the right time for that. And so the other books, I started with the book before that that was called The Hypnotist's Love Story, and I had elements of suspense in that, so I'd sort of started playing with that rather than just, character-driven stories. And I do remember some readers getting a little frustrated with that book because I think they thought I was about to go off in that direction. And then I didn't. It was all too nice for them. Because it was a book about a stalker. And I think some readers would have preferred if the stalker had murdered somebody, but she didn't. She just she got over it. and so I think it was something about taking that darker turn with The Husband's Secret. Because I always remember a reader from the US writing to me, and he said something like, I don't know what happened to you with The Husband's Secret. He said, you used to be so funny, but I hope nothing's happened to you. and I had to sort of say, well, the problem is that book did, much better than my previous book, so I'll probably keep taking these darker turns. And I did enjoy it. I enjoyed taking that turn.
What would you say is the through line in your fiction, if you can see one?
I did have one journalist say to me once that he thought my books were very Catholic, and
that's interesting.
A lapsed Catholic, and so about guilt and moral dilemmas. I feel like I do, return to similar themes all the time. Almost embarrassingly so, where I think I'm writing something completely different and then I think, oh no, here we are again. So I think, perhaps they're all about guilt. And then there are little things that other people notice. Apparently I'm always talking about banana muffins. And somebody wrote and said, can I please get your recipe for banana muffins, because obviously you like them because you're always talking about them. and it's nothing to do with, I don't particularly like banana muffins. I think it's just something with the voluptuousness of those words, banana muffins, that I enjoy, as opposed to the muffins themselves.
That is a pleasing phrase, banana muffins.
It is, yes.
So I just want to go back to what you said, that you wouldn't want people to read your work while it's in progress and that there are always things that need to be changed later. And I remember last time I spoke to you, you talked about how you always have a document called Things I Need to Fix that you're kind of adding to as you go along. Would you talk me a little bit through how you work and maybe some of the trickiest things that you've had to go back and fix?
Oh, what are the trickier things? I haven't ever had to go back and completely change anything, because I don't go too far in one direction unless I feel confident about it. I think if I then just start to slow down if I can't work out the solution, and perhaps just keep on working on a particular chapter. I remember reading, might have been Sadie Smith. She said something about you can tell the authors who are not planners because their early chapters are too polished. You know, they've gone back over and over those early chapters. And I knew exactly what she meant, because I think if I don't know where the book's going, then I each time I'd go to the document, I'd just keep working on that first chapter, thinking, okay, will it be this? Will it be that? And then it's only when I feel happy, or at least I know the next chapter can go in this direction, then I then keep going. So I've never had to go back and really change. Sometimes in the editing process, I've shuffled things around a lot. Then normally the things in this, things I need to fix, they're normally only little things. Like I probably mentioned to you with this, with the new book, it became important that Stan, one of the main characters, would not have a mobile phone. And then I'd write, you're going to have to take his mobile phone away from him, because in one of the early scenes, I had him sitting there in bed scrolling through his mobile phone. So don't forget, you're going to. So they're tiny things like that that yeah. I need to do.
But so the plot kind of just emerges as you go?
Yes. Yeah. Which perhaps means one review where they use the term baggy for my novels. Maybe that's why, because maybe they'd be tighter if I did have it all worked out right at the beginning, because it is sort of from the character. So things that the characters, as I'm working on them, some little thing that they'll say or think, that will then drive the plot. So yeah, it just emerges as part, and I love that, because the book surprises me too.
Yeah. You read your reviews then, Leanne?
No, so I'd not meant to, and I've put on the public record that I don't read my reviews, so that's outed me that I know that word.
You're a secret baggy review reader.
I do not read Amazon reviews or Goodreads reviews. So sometimes I've seen a headline and it seems like it's positive, so I've thought, oh, I might be safe to go into that review, and then I thought, oh no, you shouldn't have, because there's some nice paragraphs, and all of a sudden the only thing I can remember is the word baggy.
Oh no. I saw something on Twitter the other day, a novelist who had screenshotted a really bad review that somebody had written on social media and then tagged her in it to kind of make sure she would see it. It's just, I don't understand the
such
rationale
bad manners
behind that. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, you're right. So I do get to see things sometimes because people do put it on my own, and I think that is, surely it's safe. They wouldn't have put it here. And often it is mostly positive, but of course the only thing you remember is the negative thing. And sometimes well-meaning friends, they want to tell you about something negative that they've read that they disagree with, or that somebody else disagreed with. And I'm saying, you don't need to tell me that part.
So Big Little Lies and Nine Perfect Strangers have both been adapted for television. And I know you don't adapt your books yourself, but I'm interested to know how much you're in the loop while those shows are being written and while they're being produced, and you know, what is your interaction with it, and at what point are you invited to see something?
Well, so in both those adaptations, I was asked if I wanted to write the screenplay myself, but because I don't plan my novels, and because for me part of the pleasure in writing is finding out what happens, I could take no pleasure in thinking of adapting my own work. And so I was just kept involved just on the sidelines. So, you know, they were always just saying to me, do you want to see any of the scripts yet? I was invited to visit the set. I did for Nine Perfect Strangers. I suggested Melissa for the role of Frances, and was so thrilled that
she's brilliant.
They managed to get her. She was incredible. And the whole cast was incredible. I loved it. So But really, that was it. I was just really kept involved from the sidelines.
And Nine Perfect Strangers in particular, the adaptation diverges a lot from your book. Were you surprised by any of the changes?
Was I surprised? There's some nice extra twists that were added in, and so I was not expecting some of those twists. So I was surprised as the audience was surprised, and as I'm sure they hoped that as the audience was meant to be surprised. I've always understood that there should be changes. I don't necessarily think a book should be adapted, you know, with complete accuracy. That it's a different medium, and particularly for a television series, you need, you know, each episode to have its own arc. So I was happy to see the enjoyed seeing the changes, and you know, when readers say to me, "Well, I hope they don't change your book," I always say, "Well, they can't change my book, so that's because the book's still there. That's the, you know, your experience of reading the book is always there, and that's where I'm in charge of that world when I'm writing it. And then I guess I have to let it go, and then each reader has their own interpretation, and then for these adaptations, there are another interpretations again.
Yeah, I suppose in that sense, it's kind of just an extension of what you would have with the book anyway, which is that the reader takes it and makes something else of it in their head. So
exactly. And I know that each reader has something quite different, because sometimes readers say to me something about some particular scene, and as they're describing that scene, they're adding little parts in. So I'm thinking, no, I didn't write that. That's your imagination that you've added in. It's something from their own experiences. So, you know, if you're describing a beach or something, it's a beach they've been to.
Yeah.
So I always find that so interesting with children's books, when I look back on books that I loved as a child sometimes that I thought were so wonderfully written. But in fact, the language was very simple. It was and I think not just me, but every child has this incredible imagination that you don't need all that much to create these amazing scenes in your mind. And so exactly as you say, the filmmakers have done that too, but put them on screen.
Yeah. How has the success of those adaptations affected your career as a novelist?
Well, it's definitely obviously brought me many more readers who would otherwise never have heard of my books, so I'm just very, very grateful for that. What else has it meant? And it's just meant some glamorous interludes, like going to the Emmys, and just some fascinating insights into another world. I didn't expect to enjoy it as much as I did, just the fun of it, of seeing the whole process. So it's just been, I always describe it as just a really lovely perk of the job, these two, the two adaptations. And I've made some really lovely new friends, which, again, wasn't something I expected. I feel I was very lucky that not every author is, you know, has such an enjoyable experience that I think some other authors are, you know, dismissed, whereas I was kept involved as much as I wanted to be involved, and it was just really good fun. But still not the point of what I do. The point of what I do is still the novels. That's I never want to sit down when I do sit down to write a new book and I begin my special new ritual. I do not want to think. I don't want the future adaptation to be in my mind. It's the novel.
So you have two sisters who are published authors. Do you talk to them a lot about writing, and is that quite, I mean, I know, I think having a community of other writers is quite important to a lot of writers, being able to have those conversations with somebody without them glazing over because they're, you know, they don't want to hear about the writing process or whatever.
Mm.
Is that important to you, that you have those two siblings who you can talk to about it?
Yes, I do feel, I feel very lucky that we're there for each other, that you know, if I do accidentally happen upon the description of my plots as baggy, I can text my sisters and they can say, oh, what are they talking about? They don't know what they're talking about. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Yeah, my sister, both of them are really good at our outrage on each other's behalf if there's anything that's hurt our feelings. So I feel very lucky. Also, I'm not good at social media, so my youngest sister, Nicola, she's always looked after. She and her husband's a graphic designer, and they've always helped me with, and they have all the technical skills, so she's helped me there.
Yeah. It's funny you say that about reviews, because me and my sister are both journalists, and of course that means that sometimes you get really slagged off online by somebody who doesn't like you. My sister is always the first person I talk to, and vice versa, I think. But we sort of read out people's comments about us to each other, and then we laugh a lot about, you know, because yes. It's funny sometimes to hear how much a stranger can take a dislike to you based on quite a small amount of information.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the other thing we sometimes do for each other, is text each other nice reviews, because all of us try to avoid reading reviews because it's not safe. But to send screenshots of nice things that we've found. And then, that's a lovely gift. If one of us is having a down day, then we'll screenshot good stuff.
What are you striving for in your writing, would you say?
I think clarity. I think when I read Anne Tyler's work, who's one of my favourite novelist, so you need to pick up a page and just in a few short sentences she can create such a picture that you can instantly see. And I always want my novels to have, what I enjoy myself is the humanity or heart. I want my books to have heart. I'm not so interested in I enjoy crime if there's heart in it. I'm not so interested in who did it, you know, unless I care enough about the characters. So I think I'm just striving to make my readers care. They don't have to like the characters, but they have to care what happens to them.
And is there anything that you tend to find particularly challenging as a writer?
Oh, I'm not good at landscape. You know, I don't think that's my strength. I have no idea how to. I remember I was doing a bushwalk with a friend the other day, and she was actually saying she enjoyed the book, and she was saying, I'm glad you don't have too much description of landscape, because I always skip those paragraphs. And I was saying, well, that's good, because I can't write those paragraphs. And as we were walking along, I was saying, see, how could I describe this? You know, leaves, green, I don't know. Dappled light creek. I can't do it. So landscape, and sometimes you need a little bit of it. So sometimes you can fake it. You can actually fake. I don't mean that you steal somebody else's work, but you just, it, even though it doesn't flow as well, you might spend ages on a few sentences, you can get away with it. I always remember there was a house that I described in one of my books. And again, that was something that I thought, I'm not somebody with a particular interest in interior design. And so I was just looking up styles of architecture, and I managed to write a couple of paragraphs describing a house. But so many readers came up saying, oh, and that house, the house on the beach, they could see it so clearly. So I just thought that was interesting that I got away with it.
Yeah, you just need a little bit to trigger somebody's imagination.
Yes, exactly, and you can do it. So I couldn't have gone on and on. I couldn't have done too much more, but I had enough that we were in the house, and then I could get back to my characters, because that part I find much easier.
Yeah. Can you think of anything specific that you've learnt over the years that has really improved your writing?
If I look at some of my earlier novels, I want to chop. I feel like the sentences are too frilly. Maybe they're too baggy. See, I've said that word too many times. But I can see some of those sentences where they're trying too hard, and I want to go chop, chop, chop. And it's amazing how you can chop a sentence and then it's so much cleaner and it's so much more powerful by taking something out. I think when you begin, you think the more you can squeeze in, the better. But in fact, sometimes it's the opposite.
And what are you proudest of when you look at your writing life so far?
I think I feel the most pride when I think of the readers who have told me what my books have meant to them. So whether it's readers who've told me that about my books getting them through difficult times, you know, with sick parents or sick children, because my books are easy reads, that they've been a distraction for them or brought them comfort. Then there are other things where I've talked about issues that have meant something to them. So, you know, in the signing lines at different book events, I've had, I get quite teary. We all get teary because, you know, I've talked about infertility. So some, you know, women have come up and said, thank you for writing about infertility. And then, you know, sometimes I've had their happy ending and sometimes they have not yet. They're still on that journey. And I've written about domestic violence and I've had women coming up to me and saying, I gave a copy of this book of Big Little Lies to all my friends and said, this is me. And that was this woman's way of letting all her friends know what she'd been through. So I think it's just the reactions from the readers, that's what makes it all worthwhile.
A huge thank you to Leanne Moriarty. Her most recent novel is the family mystery Apples Never Fall, and you can buy that and browse all of her titles in the In Writing shop at uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing. And there's a link to that in the show notes. This episode was sponsored by The Novelry, the online writing school loved by authors and trusted by the world's leading literary agencies. Book a free chat with The Novelry today to see what they can do for your writing and visit thenovelry.com to find out more. Thank you to everyone who's been in touch or left reviews since this new series began. It makes me very happy and grateful to hear from you. There are three more episodes to come, so I'll see you next Friday.